Hi everybody, this is Keith Scott Mumby, and this is the renaissance, as it were, of Alternative Doctor Radio. Some of you, I know, have missed it. And let's face it, I kind of missed it myself. It hardly seems a chore to have to do these little talks. I usually have a lot of fun. So it's great to be back, and let's kick off as I used to do for my Naked Doctor Radio show, which was broadcast from Palm Springs. I used to do a little kind of roundup of the news before we got down to today's serious topic. Actually, today's topic isn't very serious at all. It's the placebo effect. And it's quite amazingly fun and interesting when you start to dig into the placebo effect. It's something that gets talked about a lot. It's something used by the pseudo-scientists to bash their opposition and talk about double-blind placebo-controlled trials. You'll just see how much of a folly and a hypocrisy that is, actually, when we get down to looking at the details. But as I say, let's kick off by looking at some news. And first of all, I'd like to share an amazing story. This comes from the UK. It was published in a newspaper called the Daily Mail. And it was about a tiny little baby. His name was Dylan Ardil, and he was a twin. He was born very early, in fact, just a few weeks, hardly at a survivable age. He was less than 2 pounds when he was born. He could have fitted into the palm of his father's hand, except that they wouldn't put him in the father's hand. He was whipped off straight to an incubator and filled up with tubes and so on. He looked very tiny and fragile in the press release photographs. Because he was premature, he suffered a bleed to the brain. He also had a hole in his heart. His lungs hadn't formed properly. Everything was against him. Well, not quite everything, as we'll see. But the medical profession certainly was. They were making the usual prognostications. Oh, this baby, this fetus is busted. We can't fix it. Don't expect him to survive. You know, the usual kind of attitude. Well, hey, he did survive, and actually quite remarkably. The mother tells a very moving part of the story where they used to sit by his incubator hour after hour, day after day. But there was a point where the baby suddenly squeezed the mother's finger. And actually they were able to catch that as a photograph. It was taken by ultraviolet light. But that seemed to be a kind of turning point. From that moment, mother and father were very sure that the child would survive. It was very clear that there was a little spirit, a little conscious being in occupation at that time. And I guess that, in a way, was his first communication. You know, I used to do with unconscious people. One of the ways I used to do to get into communication with an unconscious person is just put your fingers in their hand and just say, squeeze my finger. You'd be astonished how often a so-called unconscious person actually does just that and will squeeze your finger. Anyway, this was the little baby. As I said, a great turning point. And from then on, he started to recover. And it all went well. His lungs developed into good, decent, healthy, strong lungs. The hole in the heart healed up. It just makes you think, really, where the medical profession is at. You know, you can talk about all these birth defects and genetic problems. But somehow life comes out there with the signal, with the full message of a healthy life, and that can be translated at any time into a physical person. I'm going to talk one of the broadcasts in the near future. I'm planning to talk about genes and the way the gene story is literally falling apart. A lot of us don't really see, let's put it this way, genes do not have the power that they used to have, that life energies can override the power of the genes anytime. Yes, that reminds me of another story about raising a baby against odds, a baby that was struggling for life. It was a little child called Emma, a female child this time, born at 25 weeks, pretty premature. And this little tiny creature, when she was born, kept stopping breathing, which is a bit tricky. She had to be reminded to breathe again. So they a little shocked. You know how you... it's an old image. You don't do it these days. You probably get sued for assault. But the old days, we used to slap them on the bottom to make the baby cry. It's almost a kind of myth. It's not been done in my time as a doctor, I can tell you that. But anyway, there is something to that story. You know, a sudden sharp shock will cause a intake of breath like that, and that can be really good to start a baby off breathing. Unfortunately, little baby, she kept stopping breathing repeatedly, and they had to tickle her. That's right, that was the medical treatment. Tickle her. Every time she stopped breathing, the mother or the nurses would tickle her feet, and she'd start breathing again. Anyway, amazingly, she survived, and she's now several years old and has done really well. So thank goodness somebody had the patience and probably the sense of humour to keep tickling. Okay, another story I picked up. This is from a favourite journal. It's called The New Scientist. It's the UK's kind of equivalent of Scientific American, but it's often quite jokey and irreverent. It's not as po-faced and stiff as Scientific American, in other words. But this particular article was looking at the difference between gay and straight people. Hey, well, you know, my home's in Palm Springs. I don't know if you do know, but the official city record is that 40% of that population are gay. There are reasons why that is. It don't need to concern us, but it does seem to be a magnet for gay people. Anyway, this article was about a study recently produced. This was work done at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. I've spent time in Sweden. Stockholm's a beautiful city. And the Karolinska Institute is actually one of the world's great scientific investigative centres. They really are genuinely scientific and varied in their approach. They're not at all dominated by the drug industry just because they require outside funding. Anyway, this particular study showed they looked at functions of the brain and brain structures and compared them with straight people of the opposite sex. So lesbians were paired up against straight males and male gays paired up against straight females. And there were some interesting discoveries. In fact, they found that brain features did tend to match up quite closely like that. Main investigators in the study claimed is that they were trying to study things that were formed at birth. Now, I have to tell you, I consider that the big weakness of this study. There's absolutely no concrete reason why you should assume that limbic pathways and amygdala and so on don't change after birth. But anyway, they made some assumptions, and that was the basic assumption. You know, it's no good testing things like, you know, are you aroused by the picture of a female or a male face? I mean, that's kind of conditioned things. That could just be conditioned by sexual habits. It teaches us very little. But if you study set physical structures and there are differences, then you're onto some kind of scientific basis. And this is what they tried to do. They studied 25 heterosexuals and 20 homosexuals of each gender. Okay, so that was like 50 straight people in all and 40 homosexual persons, but from both genders. And as I said, they found that the lesbian women matched up with the straight men. They had asymmetric brains. Now, what you'll find remarkable, I expect, and I do, is that actually the right hemispheres were slightly larger than the left. In gay men and straight women, by the way, they were equal, they were symmetrical. But why should male brains be bigger on the right, or lesbians? Because they're tending towards male, I guess. You see, that doesn't quite fit with the typical myth, does it, of the right brain and left brain. You know, women are right brain, they're creative, they've got that kind of emotional side dominance. And the men are left brain, they're rational, they're linear and so on. That's what we all teach. Hey, that's what I've taught many a time. However, if you look at physical size, and that's not quite the same thing as function, but generally we tend to assume it leads. So if they've got a bigger right brain, they've got more right brain function. That's what we'd expect. So I found that a little bit counterintuitive. And it's interesting, you know, whether it was acquired at birth or not, the fact is that by adulthood, they had brains that were asymmetrical in that way. They also found other structural differences. I mentioned, for example, the amygdala. That's it's part of the emotional neurological pathways. Now, I'm not saying all emotions tied down to the brain, but certainly a lot of it is. And it was interesting, the differences between the two. The connectivity in gay men and straight women, they had signals that ran mainly into the regions of the brain that mediate mood and anxiety type of things, what you might dismissively pass off as, you know, women's things. The gay men fitted with that too, that they're more emotional. Gay men tend to suffer more with mood disorders or depression. The problem is, of course, trying to disentangle that from the fact that they're social misfits somewhat. I mean, we're in a more liberal age, but still, there's a lot of homophobia. That's enough to make anybody depressed, I suppose. On the other hand, the straight men and the lesbians, their amygdala sent their messages mainly to the sensory motor cortex. That's the activity or the function or movement part of the brain, you know, that moves your arms and legs. That's what you mean by sensory motor. It's more to do with straight biological responses, you know, flight and fight and those kind of things. So it's interesting. I don't know what it's telling us, but it's telling us something interesting, which is that there's a genuine sort of crossover of certain physical characteristics anyway. It isn't just conditioned training. And as I say, I don't believe that the study actually establishes that something there is present at birth. But we do know that, you know, the presence of testosterone, for example, is very important at the time, you know, of the developmental transformations. The amount of estradiol and all these things actually can influence the ultimate gender of the fetus, and if the substances are present in the wrong quantities at the wrong time, it can go a bit wrong, so that you get a fetus or a child that has male sexual characteristics but actually some of the behavioral characteristics of a female, and vice versa. Okay, just thought you'd like to know that. All right, now as I suggested or I hinted to you, the subject of today's talk is going to be what we call a placebo effect. It's a word that the people use a lot. They pass it around thinking they understand what it means. I can assure you that nobody really understands this phenomenon properly. It's very much more complicated and interesting than you think. In fact, it's utterly, utterly fascinating. Placebo, it's really a Latin word. Placebo means I shall please or I please. It usually means, or it's considered to mean, a pharmacologically inert substance. In other words, just using a salt solution or a starch tablet or pink medicine that's just pink dye and sugar. There's nothing active, no active ingredients, so it's said. There is one of the problems, I can tell you right away. But anyway, let's take it at face value. It means there's nothing really there, but the patient thinks there is. And the doctor may or may not be complicit in pretending. In other words, the doctor may imply it's really good medicine and the patient takes it. And of course, part of the interesting story is that people often get well taking a placebo. In fact, sometimes more people get well taking a placebo than get well taking a drug. That's something to laugh at perhaps, but as I say, once you start to dig deeper, it gets really quite complicated. It's not just confined to drugs and chemicals and substances, by the way. People have even used fake surgery and other kinds of fake therapies to be placebos. Anyway, let's look at the history of it. As I say, it's an old word, but it really became a big thing in modern times with a man called H.K. Beecher. He evaluated a number of clinical trials using different diseases, and he found that about 35% of 1,000 patients, almost 1,100 patients, 35% of them were satisfactorily relieved by the placebo alone. He published a book called The Powerful Placebo, 1955 book. Some other studies have calculated that the placebo effect is even bigger than Beecher claimed. In fact, there are studies that show it could be as much as 50 or 60%. Of subjects with certain conditions. You know, some things are more open to conditioning with the placebo effect than others. Pain is the most notorious, but also depression, some heart ailments, gastric ulcers and stomach complaints, you know, belly aches and so forth. These seem particularly amenable to the placebo approach. Now we have a whole rash of drugs that are supposed to modify brain chemistry, you know, serotonin and dopamine and all those things. And in fact, there's a lot of research that they tend to bury or ignore or rubbish that shows that most of this stuff isn't really any better than a placebo. The importance of the placebo, you probably know, is in particularly in connection with trying to establish the validity or trying to be scientific about establishing the validity of a treatment. What you do is give something that you want to test to a group of people. You give half of them the real thing and half of them a fake or placebo and see if there's a difference. If there's no difference, then you assume that that substance doesn't really have any benefit. If as sometimes happens, more people taking the placebo get well than took the drug, that can be a bit embarrassing, but it does happen. Anyway, this chap Beecher, he started a whole wave of studies, really, and people then started to research and try and investigate and try and understand how it could be. The studies are varying quality, but overall, it's very consistent that there is a placebo effect, that people will and can and do recover from really sometimes quite distressing symptoms by virtue of nothing more than an inactive substance like coloured water or sugar pill or something like that. Of course, the people that don't like this, they're busy trying to attack it. A lot of them, I know, have been paid by the drug industry to try and rubbish this story. I'm not saying that Keenly were in any way influenced by the drug industry, but they published eventually what they called a reanalysis of Beecher's data. And they said that they found that there was no evidence of any placebo effect in any of the studies cited by him. I can tell you that is complete baloney. In fact, it's an outright scientific lie. But they're obviously working to an agenda. They said that there were real improvements in health, but nothing to do with the placebo effect. And they called this false impressions of the placebo effect. And they cited all sorts of things. They said it was spontaneous improvement. It was fluctuation of symptoms. It was regression to the mean. By that, they just mean going back to average. It was additional treatment, or it was conditional switching of placebo treatments, or a scaling bias. They had a battery of these things, polite answers, apparently, experimental subordination. That means people not being free to do or say what they want because they're under pressure, because they're in an experiment. Conditioned answers and neurotic or psychotic misjudgment. Hey, this is complete hogwash. Let me tell you, all of these things happen, all of them, but they also happen and apply to active drugs. Of course they do. So they not only fail to establish their claim, but they actually show themselves to be scientifically completely inept. None of the phenomena that they say explains placebo is prevented from working in the case of the active compound. So we're back to where we started. You take a bunch of people with placebo who maybe suffered all these things like spontaneous improvement, and another bunch of people who also maybe suffered some spontaneous improvement but took a drug. Now, isn't there a difference? And the important point that Beecher showed was that there often isn't a difference, and that in fact you don't need the drug at all. You can compare having a substance to no substance, and there's still some kind of response. So we're now used to calling that the placebo response. And you can't sort of whitewash it by saying, oh, well, it's just the natural course of the disease. The natural course of the disease is also present if the person is taking drugs. So what difference does it make? Okay, let's take a little break here for some music. Thank you. Okay, well, I hope you liked that. I love these haunting Celtic tunes, sometimes a bit melancholic, I suppose, but beautiful nonetheless. And I know a lot of you do like listening to those. I've had some nice emails over the time about my choice of music, so I'm happy with that. Okay, this is not strong caffeine music at all. It's more kind of let's chill out with a glass of wine type music. Okay, now let me tell you about another important study. If you look into this, if you Google it and start reading for yourself, you're going to come across a study for sure that was published in May 2001 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it's supposed to prove that there's no such thing as the placebo effect. Remember what I said about the drug industry being willing to pay a lot of money to try and bury this idea that there is such a thing as an effective placebo effect. And of course, I don't need to tell you, the New England Journal of Medicine is completely controlled by the pharmaceutical industry, not by its editors or by its shareholders. Period. Anyway, this study was called Is the Placebo Powerless? It's an analysis of clinical trials comparing placebo with no treatment. It was Danish research at this time, not Swedish. Now, I used to spend time in Sweden, had some good Swedish friends, and no real trouble with the names. But the Danish names, let me take a shot just once, and it's Asbjørn Sjobjartsen and Peter C. Goetsche. Okay, so Sjobjartsen and Goetsche are the two names. I probably won't try those again. I'm quite good at names, but I'm not that good. Anyway, they claim was they found little evidence in general that placebos had powerful clinical effects. But, and it's the but that counts, they did what's called a meta-analysis. That means they dragged together 114 studies and compared no treatment with placebo, and they claimed there were no difference in the outcomes and so on. Okay, so the two or three, certainly two serious problems with this kind of approach. First of all, there's always a bias, a researcher bias, where they choose 114 studies that probably were poor or already said they showed there was no effect. So they don't randomly choose the top or the best 114 studies. Believe me, they choose the ones that fit their agenda anyway. So it's not 114 random studies, whatever they claim. The other problem with this is that if you start pooling a whole bunch of trials together, then you can actually deliberately or accidentally dilute the effect that any one of them is showing. Let me tell you how this works. Let's say you wanted to test the effect of morphine in a variety of conditions. You wanted to test whether it was useful in gut disorders, for pain, for heart disease, for marital discord, depression, schizophrenia, and so on. You did hundreds of studies on all these different things and then compared the results. You'd probably find that morphine didn't look as if it had very much of an effect, because we already know it doesn't have an effect on marital discord or schizophrenia, depression, and so on. In fact, its main use is pain, of course. So if you drag in too many studies with too much variety, you will actually dilute out. And as I said, it can be deliberate, believe it or not, or accidental. But you know, the bottom line is that you dilute out the effect that you're looking for. And that's the main problem with Robertson's study. They studied a lot of people, a large number of pooled people, but in fact, it doesn't really have the power and meaning to me. And of course, other people have criticized it, not just me. There are plenty of doctors who are well aware of the fact that there really is a placebo effect and just took with a pinch of salt this one that claims it proved once and for all that there wasn't such a thing. Robertson claim that, you know, it's all their methods are flawed. You know, those that show there's been a placebo effect, they're flawed research and methodology. The usual mudslinging. And of course, anyone can sling mud at Robertson's study. In my view, it's pretty poor, actually. It wasn't designed to show anything meaningful. It really looks like it was designed to cover up the placebo effect. And if it wasn't, that's exactly what it did anyway. What's interesting is that not very long after that, there's an interesting study brought out that showed almost exactly the opposite. This is a complex study, but I'll try and I'll try and water it down for you so that you get the point. I'm merely saying that, you know, right after this fellow, the two Danish fellows claim to have disproved it, out comes a study that showed they were completely wrong, that there is definitely a placebo effect. This was in what are called thoracotomized patients. You know how we love these big words, but that really just means they'd had their chest open, usually for draining fluid or for heart operations, bypass operations and so on. Any reason to open the chest? Of course, the majority of these were cardiac bypass patients. And they were divided into three different groups. First of all of them were allowed to ask for painkillers when they wanted them. They were using buprenorphine, which is quite powerful, or said to be. Said to be powerful beyond the placebo effect. Hey, it's getting tricky already. There were three different groups. First, they weren't told anything. They all have intravenous fluid washes of the chest, by the way. That's standard. And the first group were not told anything about any possible painkiller effect of that. The second group were told that the fluid washout that was being used to rinse the inside of their chest was either a powerful painkiller or a placebo. So, in other words, it was the classic double-blind type administration. The person didn't know or not whether they were getting the placebo. The important thing to keep a grasp on, by the way, is they didn't get any active painkiller. Everyone was getting placebo in this, right? It was just salt solution. Anyway, the third group was told that this infusion was a very powerful painkiller. That was deceptive administration. They weren't told it could be or not. They were told it was. They were lied to, in other words, as part of this experiment. And of course, you'd expect different outcomes. The people that weren't told anything about possible analgesic effects of this saline wash needed a lot more drugs than those that were told that they were having what could be. One group was told it may be a painkiller, and the other group was told it's definitely a painkiller. And as you'd expect, the ones that were told it was definitely a painkiller called for the substance far less time. In fact, 34% less analgesic, right? Those that were told it was a painkiller, those that were told it might be, needed 16% less than those who were not told anything. They just hurt, they felt pain, in other words. So based on the patient's self-assessment, that is, if their pain was bad enough to ask for a pain relief pill, one group needed a lot more pills than the other. If they were told that they were having a wash that contained a powerful analgesic, they seemed to need less painkiller. Well, isn't that exactly what we've been saying all along? That if a person thinks they're getting something important or getting something that will work for them, that they will in fact get a recovery response or a helpful response. There was a well-documented study that was done many years ago. I forget when it was first published, sometime in the 60s, I think. Anyway, a cardiologist from Seattle. Oh, yes. I have my notes here. This guy was called Leonard Cobb. And he carried out a sort of trial procedure for angina. The doctors used to make a small incision in the chest and tie knots in two of the arteries, they were ordinary chest arteries, to try and squeeze more blood flow to the heart. It's pretty crude. I mean, you know, forget exercise and good diet, which opens up coronary arteries like nothing. It's amazing how much coronary arteries will recover and open up, and 94% blockages will turn into no blockages at all using an angiogram with exercise and nutrition, but doctors still won't do it. Of course, why should they when they can get $100,000 for a bypass surgery? Why should they try and cure the patient? That would be absurd. It's far better to pocket the money, isn't it? Ooh, getting cynical now. This particular surgeon did the incision but didn't tie off the arteries. In other words, it was a complete sham for some of the patients. Everyone thought it was called internal mammary artery ligation. And some patients thought they'd had it, but they hadn't, and other ones thought they had it, and they had. But But what was interesting is that 90% of the patients thought that it helped, even though they'd had, they'd had no real treatment. So even fake surgery has this very, very powerful effect. So, you know, what can we learn? Well, part of the argument is how this works. You know, is it just a psychological effect? Is it just the person's mind? We know the mind is powerful. The mind can produce healing. Why not? If you think yourself well, why you get well? It could work. But other people look for possible physical causes. Is there something physically different about what's done that has an effect? And one of the things that stimulated this was an article, again, in the Scientific American, in the New Scientist, the British journal, where a writer, he was actually a researcher called Michael Brooks, and he's written a very interesting book called 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, published by Doubleday, by the way. Only one of the 13 is placebo, but I guess he decided to include a chapter on that because it didn't make any sense. Anyway, he went and subjected himself to some tests at the University of Turin in Italy. He didn't pick it by chance. There were a couple of researchers there that had been doing important work. And what happened was they strapped an electrode to his arm and told him to relax. And then what they did was try and establish what was the least electrical current he could feel and what was the worst amount of current that he could bear, how much pain could he bear. And then basically what they did is work between the two. There was a red light was associated with the very strong, painful jolt, and a green light meant it was going to be quite mild. And so they set off shocking him, and he had very, you know, there were greens, reds, reds, greens, greens, reds, all very random. The shocks came and went. And after about 10 minutes, that was it. The 15 minutes, they finished the experiment, packed up the machine, and told him what had happened. And apparently, without him understanding, all the last several minutes of shocks had all been very severe. And yet he hadn't noticed that at all, because they'd been flashing the green light. So he got the light that was associated with mild shock, felt a mild shock, even though they were consistently giving him really quite severe, you know, real stinkers. He was deceived, basically. You know, because of the green light, he thought he was getting a strong shock and wasn't, and yet didn't feel the pain. But then that leads on to, you know, interesting discussions with this chap, Benedetti, the Italian researcher, deeper and deeper, if you like, into the problem of what does the placebo effect really mean. In fact, it's become such a problem that some researchers are calling for the term placebo to be scrapped. Well, bet some of those are working for the drug industry, I'm sure. The most important part of the problem is that for the placebo effect to work, the patient needs to be told that they're taking something. Usually you tell them that they're taking the active drug, or that they might be if it's a double-blind trial. But what was interesting was some research was done where the person was not told that they were giving the painkiller or the pain antagonist. This was a study done with a painkiller called CCK antagonist. And it actually worked better than the placebo. And so you would say, well, the CCK antagonist is an effective painkiller. Logical, okay. But then if somebody was in pain and you administered them CCK without telling them you were doing so, they got no pain relief whatsoever. So how do you interpret that? It's like saying if a person doesn't think they're taking a painkiller, they don't get any pharmacological or biological effect, whatever the double-blind study and trial appeared to be showing. So you see how complex it's starting to get. And this particular research, they led along the lines and they suggested the idea that maybe that drugs like the CCK antagonist, you shouldn't actually consider it a painkiller at all. But maybe they suggested it was more of a placebo amplifier. In other words, the placebo effect is not only present and true, but is actually important. And that certain drugs may be able to enhance the effect of what the patient believes. This is a complete turnaround, I've got to tell you. You know, instead of thinking, you know, placebo effect is something we've got to get rid of and have true drugs, the true drug effect doesn't work unless the patient believes it's going to work, even if it is an active pharmacological drug. I mean, some of these things we know do have strong pharmacological actions. But if the patient doesn't know they're getting a drug substance, the effect doesn't manifest. Where does that leave us? It gets really quite confusing. For example, if you let me give you another example. Diazepam, that's Valium, okay? It's often used after operations to calm people down, just to relax them. But you know what? Diazepam doesn't work if the patient's not told they're getting it. So in other words, it has no effect whatsoever unless you tell the person, here's a Valium. So, I mean, of course, it brings into question a whole lot of the drug industry and the problems with what they're doing, because they're trying to pass this criteria. I mean, it's a pathetic criterion. They can bring a drug to the market if they can show it's got 2% or more effect than placebo. Listen, we're looking at a placebo effect that can vary between 35%, 50%, 60%, and even 90% in the cardiac ligation artery study. And they're told 2%. I mean, it's not exactly a very high bar, is it? It's an absurdly low bar. And yet some drugs still can't pass it. You know, the old way, there's less of it now, but the old way the pharmaceutical industry used to do their trials is just test until they got an effect. They would do a trial that showed it was no good, so they'd scrap that and do another one, and that showed it was no good, so they'd scrap that and do another one, and then they'd scrap that and do another one, and suddenly one showed, here's 2.5% more effect than placebo. So we'll publish that one, and that says it's scientifically proven to work for arthritis or depression or whatever. That pathetic state of play is really where the pharmaceutical industry is at. Well, we don't trust them, but even if they were completely, totally, scrupulously honest and not the crooks that they are, there's still this big problem, which is that you know, people need to have the placebo effect needs to be present to be able to tell if the drug is working. Well, anyway, I thought you'd be interested in this appalling little irony. I think it's quite fascinating the way that research is going. So, in fact, they've decided to, rather than placebo effect as such, they've now come up with a possible term. They want to call this contextual healing. That's the aspect of healing that's produced or activated or somehow enhanced by the context of the clinical encounter rather than by any specific treatment given. I'm okay with contextual healing. I'm not okay with removing the placebo effect because that's something the very slippery pharmaceutical industry would benefit from. Having said that, I want to tell you that the placebo effect is just as valid in alternative medicine. I'm going to take another music break, and then we'll just talk about that very thing. Thank you. Okay, welcome back. This is the third segment, and I'm talking about the effect of the placebo effect of drugs. As I said just before the break, some people think that the placebo effect is purely psychological. That's almost entirely psychological, I'm sure, but whether you can rule out other things, I'm not so sure. But a guy called Irving Kirsch, he's a psychologist at the University of Connecticut. He says, for example, the effectiveness of Prozac and similar drugs can be attributed almost entirely to the placebo effect. He and another guy analyzed 19 clinical trials of antidepressants and concluded the expectations of improvement and not the adjustments in brain chemistry really accounted for about 75% of the drug's effectiveness. So remember what I said, that you know the person has to know they're taking it. It probably wouldn't produce any effect at all if the person wasn't told they were taking an antidepressant. The critical effect in all these things really is our belief about what's going to happen to us. And of course, you don't need drugs to see a profound transformation if the person believes that that's what's going to happen. Now, that's not to say there's no biochemical effect. The person's beliefs and hopes, are obviously their suggestibility and so on, all these are significant, but they can be significant because they change the biochemistry of the person's body. Obviously, particularly in the brain, we know that our thoughts and feelings and emotions and fears and expectations and so on can change our neurochemistry considerably. So, you know, why not in the rest of the body? In any case, you know, neurotransmitters don't function just solely in the brain. I think, in fact, there are some studies that suggest that's not enough, but obviously the recovery is mainly psychological. I could tell you about a trial that was done eliminating warts, you know, warts on the skin by painting them with brightly coloured inert dye. And the patients were told that the warts would be gone when the colour wore off. Well, you probably know that warts are actually a virus papilloma. It's a little virus that makes those happen. So, you know, you can think away the virus, if you like, if it's just a placebo effect. In another study, they were showed that in asthmatics, research was able to produce dilation of the airways just by telling the patient that they were having a bronchodilator, even if they weren't. Patients that are suffering from pain after a wisdom tooth extraction got just as much relief from a fake application of ultrasound as they did from a real one, just so long as both the patient and therapist thought that the machine was on. Notice we talk about double blind. If you're not sure what that means, let me tell you, which means that the practitioner or the doctor also has to know, has to be blind, has to not know which is which. Otherwise, of course, you just give definite clues. It's inevitable, you know, the doctor will know that that was the active drug, so he'll say, yeah, I'm sure you're feeling better with that, aren't you? Was that okay? That really worked, yes? Rather than saying, did I do any good? Do you know what I mean? They, you know, just the person's question or attitude or something, they'll give away strong clues, so you have to make sure it is double blind. Anyway, all those suggestions that I told you, all worked, the warts went, the bronchodilation, the pain relief, and so on, was all completely effective based on what the person believed was going to happen. In fact, you can go further and say being in the, remember I said contextual healing. I think it's a good expression, and it's been shown many times that a person needs to be in a healing situation to accompany something. So depressed patients who are only put on a waiting list but not given anything obviously didn't do as well as those who were given placebos. What was interesting is that if, let's say, you give a placebo for pain relief, the peak of relief when they tested it comes at about an hour after it's administered. That's exactly what would happen with the real drug. If taking a placebo anesthetic was the equivalent of giving nothing, then you'd obviously expect a more random pattern. So I don't want you to be in any doubt that there is such a thing as the placebo effect. What my argument now is going to be uncomfortable for some, but it must be said that this, of course, also applies equally to alternative and complementary medicine practices. And I have to say that there's a lot of very woolly thinking, imprecise thinking, and some of it, quite frankly, dishonest thinking, trying to fudge this issue. You know, patients will, or practitioners, I should say, will often say, well, I do this, this, and this, and I get terrific results. And when it comes down to it, in fact, they don't get terrific results at all. All they do is remember their successes and forget their failures. But also, they often refuse blinding or double blinding of treatments to see if there's any real effect. And that's kind of dishonest, because many times I think it is. Their argument would simply be, well, who cares? Why should I care? If the patient feels better, yeah, but I mean, if you're charging them, you know, $100 an hour for some placebo treatment, that's not really quite ethical in my view. You should certainly be willing to have it investigated, if you like. I've done it a number of times, and I've found some very interesting results. For example, people doing kinesiology, you know, whether you hold your arm out and your arm may go weak. There is so much BS talked about kinesiology, I can't tell you. I would put it as high as 95% of what you're told and what practitioners claim is garbage. I have met really good AKA or applied kinesiology practitioners, and they really can do it, but the majority can't. And if you set up some very simple tests, I've done this, you get a row of bottles or files, you blank them out so that, and then shuffle them so that nobody knows which are which. And you ask a person to use kinesiology to pick out the one that they say is the problem. 95% or more of people cannot do it. Sometimes by luck, but they cannot do it consistently. And mostly it shows they just can't do it at all. The really good ones, of course, can. And a 1 in 10 chance isn't that bad. I did a famous double-blind allergy administration trial, which we filmed and made it big time in the media in the UK. It was based on the fact that a girl considered, she reported her experience that she thought vodka sexually aroused her very inappropriately at times. And I decided it was simple enough to test, and she agreed to the test, so we tried it. We loaded up 10 syringes, 4 had alcoholic drinks, 6 were blanks. There was vodka, which of course she was interested in, whiskey, gin, and brandy, I think, was the other one. So we blanked out all the syringes so that I couldn't know what was in them, she didn't know what was in them, shuffled them all, and then start to give her a series of injections, and we had a cameraman film the whole thing from start to finish without any interruptions, no blank spots in the video, in other words. On the fourth solution, interestingly, she just became extremely provocative sexually and said to the cameraman, you know, I hope you got a good belt on because I'm having those trousers off. Yeah, yeah. One of them, she got very depressed, and one of them, she was giggly as anything, not sexually aroused, but highly, you know, giggly and silly. Anyway, we broke the code, and she was right. The solution D, which is the one that caused sexual provocation, was, in fact, the vodka. And I was also able to tell her that gin made her suicidally depressed. I warned her against ever touching gin. And I said, really, and of course, vodka's not safe. Could get her into all kinds of trouble. And I said, if you want to drink spirits, whiskey's your drink. It just makes you giggle. But, you know, that's being willing to subject what you believe to that kind of scientific-type scrutiny is something that you've got to be willing to do in alternative medicine. And it seems to me that there's a particular resistance for people who are doing, you know, for example, things like chakras and aura cleansing and those things, so-called subluxations and cranial manipulations, you ought to be able to subject it to some kind of testing and trial. And it ought to pass. And it's important. I'm not ranting against the placebo effect. I'm not saying there isn't immense value in going to see a homeopath. And if you believe homeopathy is going to work, that it's going to be very helpful to you. I'm merely suggesting that it should be possible for the practitioners to be more honest about what they're doing and be more willing to subject themselves to appropriate scrutiny. Partly the problem is if you don't, then we can be criticized. You know, one of the consistent criticisms of alternative and complementary therapies is there's no proper scientific trials. Well, you know, there are, but of course, doctors that don't like them just ignore that. acupuncture, for example, is very difficult to do double blind, especially if the person knows any acupuncture. You know, you can't put them on real acupuncture points or fake acupuncture points if the person knows what you're doing. So it is difficult. But nevertheless, the tests have been done. You know, clever people have figured out how this can be done. There's always a way. If you're willing, there's always a way. And we've got to get past the rigid dogma in alternative medicine too. Anyway, listen, I don't want to get on my soapbox and sound pompous. That's no fun for anybody. One of the great qualities and values, of course, of complementary and alternative medicine, it's hard to subject to any kind of test, and it's just the care and the loving and the attitude of the therapist. But, you know, that was studied. It's been tested in April of this year. A study was published that had looked at the treatment for irritable bowel syndrome using acupuncture. One group got sham acupuncture and lots of attention, TLC, or tender loving care, as we call it. The second group also got sham acupuncture, right, both of them, but no attention. And then the third group just got left on a waiting list. Nothing was done, in other words. Now, interestingly, both the patients in both sham acupuncture groups did better than those that were left on the it was a fake waiting list too, I guess. So, you know, having sham acupuncture is better than nothing at all. That was interesting. But what was even more revealing was that the group that felt they'd been listened to and consulted about their symptoms and feelings, they reported an improvement that was really equivalent to a very positive result in a drug trial or some other kind of trial. So, you know, the extra element of TLC and care is probably the most valuable thing that a physician or a doctor or practitioner can do. And I'd like to leave it with that. I've always, when people talk about the placebo effect or there's argument going on about whether there's such a thing, my answer is always the same. I say, hey, you know, if there is, we need to know. If there's a placebo effect, we need to find out how it works and bottle it so that we can supply it to people. If it's that good and it works and it relieves symptoms, it's not only valuable, it's something that we should be seeking out and trying to enhance. And there's no question that enhancing your confidence in your spirit and qualities as a practitioner are a very important part of the healing process. And that's what I think emerges mainly, the most important thing of all, and I'd like to leave you with that particular thought. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed this little investigation into the placebo effect. And I'll talk to you again soon with another edition of Alternative Doctor Radio. Thank you.